This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon is writer and journalist Alexander Stila. He joins us to offer his observations about the way we think about the past and our efforts to preserve it. His new book, The Future of the Past, includes essays about the Sphinx, Latin, a rainforest in Madagascar, and the Ganges River. Alexander Stila asks many questions in The Future of the Past. In the introduction, he writes, what does it mean to have a living relationship with the past, and what happens when some of those links are broken? He says, quote, our society is in the midst of a fundamental rupture with the past, which involves loss as well as gain. The benefits of the information revolution, instant worldwide communication, and universal access to infinite amounts of data are plainly evident and have been justly celebrated. Nevertheless, we should, I think, at least acknowledge and examine what we are losing as well. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited. Share your thoughts with us. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. In Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Alexander Stila is a frequent contributor to The New Yorker and The New York Times. He's the author of four books, including Benevolence and Betrayal, Five Italian Jewish Families Under Fascism, and Excellent Cadavers, The Mafia and the Death of the First Italian Republic. His new book, The Future of the Past, is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Alexander Stila, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'd like to begin with the story that provided the inspiration for this book, The Future of the Past. The title of this story is Living with a Dead Language, and it's a profile of Father Reginald Foster, senior Latinist to the Pope. Would you describe him for us?
Well, Reginald Foster is an extraordinary character whom I encountered while living in Rome in the early 1990s. He is a Carmelite monk from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, son and grandson of plumbers, and someone who grew up going to parochial school like lots of other Milwaukee kids, but who discovered a kind of genius for the Latin language when he was in grade school, simply took to it like a duck to water, and combined it with his religious vocation. It's important to remember that at the time he was coming of age, which was the 1950s, he was born in 1937, instruction in Catholic seminaries around the world, in this country and elsewhere, was all conducted in Latin. We tend to think of Latin as being a dead language, and it sort of has been a dead language since the 18th century. But as I said, all of the instruction that he received in seminary and above was all conducted in Latin. So in their classes, where they were talking about philosophy or mathematics, it was all being done in Latin, so that ordinary priests and not just scholars of Latin knew it and were able to speak it the way we're speaking English. And he made it his particular vocation and went on to become the... he works in one of the only offices in the world where people speak Latin, and he's translating all of the... documents of the church into Latin, which is still at least nominally the official language of the church. What was appealing and exciting about him was that is the incredible passion that he has for what he does and the way that he lives in a mental world that's related to the Latin language. Since Latin has been spoken since about the 8th century BC, around the founding of Rome, and is still used today in the Vatican, and it's important to remember that it was still the language of scholarly communication and intellectual life well into the 18th century. You know, if you remember that the great philosophers of the Enlightenment, people like Descartes and Spinoza and Leibniz were all writing to one another in Latin. Latin was the language of communication the way English and is now the language of the Internet. That stopped a few centuries ago, but there's this enormous literature that goes on for over 2,000 years that Foster is intensely aware of, and he lives in a world that is peopled by the people that wrote this language. And so when you go around Rome with him, you have this kind of you have the sense of living in a world populated by dozens of generations of different people who are all speaking to one another through the monuments that you see, through the inscriptions on the buildings that you see. And it simply got me thinking about what it means to have a living relationship with the past, and what it means then when that begins to break down, as it is breaking down in the church, as Foster himself fully recognizes. And that got me to sort of thinking about ways in which our own world was changing in ways that are maybe more obvious and closer to many of us. I started thinking about, for example, the problem of monuments, which also in Italy as elsewhere are under enormous pressure from development, pollution, and you know, mass tourism. So that I then decided to pursue this this project, The Future of the Past, and look at ways in which we were both gaining and losing knowledge through technological change. And so I did three chapters that deal with monuments. And there, for example, you see the problem in a very cute way in Egypt, where the first chapter is set, where we're both gaining wonderful kinds of knowledge through things like radar images from satellites in space that tell us what the penetrate the sands of the Egyptian desert and tell us what the topography of the country looked like 30,000 years ago, but the monuments of ancient Egypt themselves are being eroded by pollution, the rising water table of the Aswan Dam, mass tourism, and so forth. So that paradoxically, we may end up with virtual realities of the monuments of the Valley of the Kings and Queens in Egypt, but the tombs themselves may no longer exist. And so that sort of got me on the trajectory that that carried me through this book, and I began to think about the problem in a number of other areas of life, not just physical monuments, but, for example, in nature itself, where we both are gaining extraordinary knowledge through genetic research and able to reconstruct the history of species going back millions or sometimes hundreds of millions of years through DNA analysis, but the species in the world that we move around in are decreasing at a increasingly rapid rate. Or, for example, among human societies themselves, we're both, this last generation has perhaps done a better job than any other in history in seriously documenting respectfully all sorts of small and isolated cultures around the world that were dismissed until recently as primitive or savage. But at the same time, those isolated traditional cultures are being rapidly homogenized into mainstream cultures during the phase of globalization. So, for example, there are 6,500 languages spoken around the world, but it's estimated that half of them will no longer be spoken a century from now. So that with each of those, the disappearance of each language, we're losing a culture, a mental universe, and so that whether it's with the disappearance of species or the disappearance of monuments or the disappearance of languages and traditional societies, I think we realize that the world we're living in is in a certain sense becoming more homogenized, less rich in certain ways, and that's sort of the problem that I wanted to explore in this book.
Yeah. Well, thinking back to Father Foster and thinking about Latin and thinking about languages and species and the loss of cultures, you note in the introduction that the spread of Latin wiped out scores of local languages and cultures. And today, as you just said, many other languages are at risk of being wiped out. Can we prevent the loss of a language?
You know, some of it is inevitable because it's only natural for people to want to be part of a larger community and to want to be able to communicate with their fellow creatures, and a lot of that is necessary and good. One wouldn't want to say to people on a tiny island somewhere in the Pacific that they shouldn't learn, let's say, the language group that the majority of other people in their country speak. And yet we also feel that it's important to preserve those particular cultures. I think there are some things that can be done, and one of the things that the last 50 years have shown is that there are many cultures that have revived languages and maintained them. Gaelic, for example, is now more widely spoken in Ireland than it was a generation ago. And Irish children learn both Gaelic and English with no loss of of knowledge of English. In Israel, Hebrew was revived from practically brought back from the dead, and people there are almost universally bilingual and work very well in a globalized world, while at the same time preserving their own traditional culture. And there are things being done in that vein among Native Americans in this country. We tend to forget that there are still 300 Native American languages spoken in the U.S., and many of them, unfortunately, spoken only by a small number of people. But a lot of these groups, which used to be ashamed of speaking their own native language and not English, have now sort of had a change of heart and are taking steps to try to preserve their language and their culture. And I think that's healthy. I think we've come to realize that people can have double or multiple identities and still function effectively as modern people. And so I think in many ways our culture is more tolerant of that than was the case 20 or 50 years ago.
Well, now let's jump ahead to Madagascar, where efforts at preservation are coming up against the immediate needs for people to make a living to survive. What took you to Madagascar?
Well, I wanted to pursue this theme that I mentioned earlier about species and both the preservation and loss of species, and Madagascar seemed like a perfect place to do it because it's this enormous island that's almost the size of Texas that sits off the coast of Africa in the Indian Ocean, and because of both its size and its isolation, it's produced an extraordinary number of unique species. It's estimated that 80% of the species of Madagascar are unique to that place. Many people have heard or read about lemurs, which are the primates, the sort of primitive type of primates that developed somewhat earlier than monkeys and apes that inhabit Madagascar. And so I thought that this place that's a kind of naturalist's paradise would be a perfect place to look at the problem of preserving species, because Madagascar is also a very poor place, which is changing rapidly, and therefore its environment is under a lot of pressure. I set out with, I think, a fair amount of naivete, because I had not done a lot of environmental reporting before, and it never occurred to me that there could be something wrong with trying to save a rainforest. But I began to, as I began to ask around among scientists and said, who's doing the most sort of interesting preservation work in Madagascar, I was told about a woman named Patricia Wright, who has been widely praised for finding a species of lemur that had been thought extinct for many years and then discovering a species of lemur that was undocumented scientifically. When she did this, she was then able to convince the United States government to put up money to create a national park system in Madagascar, and worked with the Madagascar government to designate areas that that could be preserve areas for lemurs and other species. And so the area that she found these lemurs in was designated as a national park, and she was then put in charge of trying to make this thing go. The project has been widely touted as a kind of example of sensitive third world conservation, because involved the U.S. working with a local government and then the national government there working with local people to try to make sure that they benefited from this project, and that, for example, proceeds from the admissions to the park would go to the villages that live nearby the park and would be affected by land being designated for preservation purposes. But what I found when I began to do the reporting was that this project was much more problematic than I had been led to believe, and that local people were, in fact, for the most part, very unhappy about the restrictions that the park placed on the use of land. Many of the villages that surround this area are desperately, desperately poor places where people live one bad harvest away from starvation. And so the loss of access to forest, which contains both firewood, agricultural land, which can be used in times of emergency, crayfish, which they like to fish from nearby streams and sell in local restaurants, and many other things, loss of access to that meant serious hardship for a lot of these people. And and many of the benefits that were promised to go with this project weren't forthcoming, including medical aid. And as I learned, some of the villages that were supposed to be benefiting from this project, people were dying en masse of dysentery and even bubonic plague. So it made me understand how much more complex the problem of third world conservation is, and how intertwined with the human environment attempts to save species are. And so a lot of one of the sort of themes of the book in the two chapters that I in which I deal with nature are about the intertwined nature of the intertwined nature of culture and nature, and the way they become sort of inseparable in our world.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting to talk with us in Chicago on the toll-free line. Good afternoon. Nope, the caller is not there. Well, I invite that caller to give us a call back at 800-222-9455. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, you can call us on the local line, 333-9455. We're talking today about the future of the past. That is the title of the new book from writer and journalist Alexander Stila. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, questions, comments, they're invited. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, maybe we could, I think that the caller from Chicago is calling us back at this moment, so let's give this person the opportunity to join us finally here and get them on the line with us. Good afternoon, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, but I can hardly hear you, but I'll make my comment.
Okay.
The University of Chicago a number of years ago decided to drop language as a requisite course in their graduate programs and institute learning of the computer languages. So that's one reason for the demise of language usage in terms of the learning and teaching. And then the other thing that seems to be more dominant in our culture today is money talks, and certainly the language of economics has become a more universal thing in the parlance of the countries and computers. So that's another factor that's contributing to the demise and the use of language, as well as the dismantling of certain neighborhoods that where ethnic groups grew up together, and on. So I just wanted to offer that comment, and thank you for the nice, enriched conversation you're having with your guest.
Okay.
I can hardly maintain this connection, so I'll have to hang up.
Okay, fine. Thanks for your call this afternoon. To our guest, would you like to comment on the comments?
Yeah, well, I'm glad that he raised those points because, in fact, he's absolutely right. I discussed some of that in the conclusion of my book, where I point out that the percentage of American college students who now learn foreign languages has dropped from 16% to 8% in the last 30 years. So that one of the strange ironies of this period of globalization, which everyone greeted as a period in which we would become intertwined with other cultures more than other, there would be mutual dependence between other cultures, we'd learn more about them, they'd learn more about us. So far, it's worked largely one way. They know a lot more about Arnold Schwarzenegger and Die Hard 2 than we know about things in Micronesia or Taiwan, and so oddly enough, we're for example, even foreign news coverage on the nightly news has dropped from 9 minutes to 6 minutes in the last 20 years. So there's a strange narrowing of focus in American life in the last generation, even as we, in fact, as September 11th made dramatically clear to us, our well-being is increasingly tied up with the problems of the rest of the world. And so that failing to be aware of other societies, other cultures, other languages is actually anything but just a matter of effete culture or you know, something it's nice to know about but not necessary for life. So I do worry about that for a lot of reasons.
Yeah. Well, one of the, you know, I really love that story of living with a dead language. Father Foster, his passion for Latin, which he shares with any and all comers, really shows us how language can open us to not only to the past but to one another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with Father Foster, he, you know, you'd spent a good deal of time in Rome prior mm-hmm. to taking that Latin course, but he gave you a new layer of appreciation for the city, insights into the politics, literature, economics, mm-hmm. art, architecture.
Well, I think that's the. I mean, I think the thing that that a kind of awareness of the layers of the past gives you, and that's one good example is that it makes you feel that you live in a much richer, fuller world than you did before. If you know, if we as a society had no memory beyond you know, last year's consumer product cycle. The world would be just unbearably poor, and the fact that you know, it's like in the same way that the children who have no knowledge of their parents or their family are often haunted by that and feel the need to reconnect with their families. I think we all have a needed to be grounded in the world that preceded us. And it's a source of, you know, of enormous, both sort of emotional comfort as well as extraordinary interest and just richness of one's life.
Mm. Being able to speak another language or know another language, also a very humanizing experience.
Well, I think the thing that is tremendously important about it, and I think. Again, its relevance to what we're living through today, post September 11th, is to the point that you know, learning another language involves putting yourself inside the mind of another culture and the mind of another person, and it forces you to look at the world differently. I think we all tend to grow up with the notion that the way we do things and the way we think about things is the way they are thought about and done. It is the right way. And working yourself into another culture, into another language, or into another time of history, both makes you aware, on the one hand, of how much different civilizations and cultures have in common, but at the same time, ways in which they can look very differently at things. You know, in the case of, you mentioned the Father Foster in the Latin chapter, you know, he gets great sort of amusement out of things in which, you know, ways in which the ancient Romans and we were remarkably similar. And so he talks about, you know, we're walking around the Palatine Hill in Rome, and he stops, actually I think in the Forum, he stops next to a place that the great orator and politician Cicero, he actually owned this thing that was rented out of the shop, and he used the proceeds from renting the shop to support his son, who was studying in Athens, which was the sort of like sending your kid back to you know, the East Coast for an Ivy League education in that day. And meanwhile, the kid was acting up and hanging around with long-haired philosophers and getting into trouble. And Cicero was writing to his friends in Athens, trying to keep an eye on his son. And Foster, who's in the middle of delivering this thing in Latin, says, "You know, same old story, same old story." You know, nothing changes. And so, you know, there's that, and at the same time, you know, people were taking pleasure from watching animals devour human beings in the Colosseum. So there are both ways in which we're profoundly different from the people of that era and ways in which we're profoundly the same. And being aware of both those aspects of things, I think, is really important to sort of understanding what's, you know, what's lasting and permanent in life and what is changeable and relative and relative.
Yeah. The first piece in The Future of the Past is about the is about efforts to preserve the great treasures of Egypt, the Sphinx and the pyramids. And it was fascinating to learn that those efforts go back thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the Sphinx is so ancient, it's believed that it was built around 2600 BC, that, you know, it was, let's say, older to the Emperor Nero, who visited it as a tourist, the way we visit ancient Rome. It was older for Nero than Nero's Rome is for us, so that gives you an idea of how old it was. It was already a very, very ancient monument when the pharaoh, Thutmose IV, who ruled in about 1400 BC, he came to power, and the Sphinx at the time was in bad disrepair, and it was buried in sand up to its chin. And he restored the Sphinx, and in fact, even today, you can see a stela or a tablet in front of the Sphinx, which is dedicated to Thutmose, and is about his restoration of the Sphinx. And he believed that the story is that he lay down for a nap in the desert outside near the Sphinx. The Sphinx came to him and said, "You will be Pharaoh, and if you will restore me." And so he restored the Sphinx after becoming Pharaoh. Leaving aside whether that's a fanciful story, he does, in fact, appear to have restored the Sphinx. And what's sort of interesting is that when you look at the history of the Sphinx and its the efforts to preserve it, the earlier efforts to preserve it were much more successful than some of the more recent ones, because they knew much more about how the monument was built. When Thutmose was restoring it, the Egyptians were still using the same building practices that the people who built the Sphinx were using, and so it was restored very successfully. When you get to the 1960s and 70s, people, in fact, didn't know how people worked, just worked with stone tools, built things, and so they used concrete and cement to try to shore up the parts of the Sphinx that were eroding rapidly in need of support. But cement has a high content of salt. Salt is very bad for monuments like that, and because when it dissolves and then recrystallizes, it pushes, it goes into the stone, and then when it crystallizes, it expands very forcefully and erodes the surface of the monument, and in fact became a real danger to the Sphinx itself. So one of the things that contemplating a monument like the Sphinx tells you is that there are ways in which we know a lot more than ancient people did, but there are also things that they knew a lot more about than we did. And so that was one of the sort of interesting ironies to me in the whole story of the Sphinx.
Another theme in that piece, though, seems to me to deal with our desire to conserve the past and what our motivation is. It seems that with conservation comes control, and control over what the past was all about, and sort of molding it to who we are today. Just like we might try and use current methods of preservation to save the Sphinx, but you know, that's not the way it was done. And do you see what I'm meaning?
Well, one of the things I tried to kind of get into in that chapter was the both the impossibility and inevitability of trying to preserve things. In one sense, what we're preserving when we preserve something like the Sphinx is not the past, but in fact the present. What we have in the Sphinx and the pyramids, these extraordinary monuments. The Sphinx, for example, in ancient times was painted bright colors. So what's been passed down to us is something kind of different. We are, in fact, trying to preserve simply what's remained in the present of the past. We're trying to freeze a moment in the life of this monument, which is both impossible, but it seems also very compelling because, if nothing else, we will never have more of the past than what is in that frozen moment. And so the chapter is about both the craziness, impossibility, and yet inevitable desirability of trying to stop time. And the pyramids were built with the idea that they would last forever. Nothing does, but they've come closer than anything. So it's really an examination of, you know, both the Egyptians' desire to build forever and our desire to keep things forever. But it's full of ironies and accidents because what we have, you know, the fact that we've decided to preserve the Sphinx and the pyramids and we've invested them with so much importance in our own culture is partly the result of an accident. There were, hundreds of extremely important, beautiful buildings and monuments that have been just were destroyed by accident in the past, and we would revere them as much as we now do the Sphinx and the pyramids, but because they were built, let's say, of mud brick instead of a hard stone like limestone, they don't survive. So we now consider these to be more important than almost any other. So I wanted to reflect a little bit about how sort of accidental, in a sense, our idea of what the past is.
Mm.
And another aspect to that I wanted to deal with in the second chapter, I deal with China and their very different relationship to monuments. And there, they don't build in stone for the most part. They build in wood. And so their approach to preserving the past was totally different. Unlike the Egyptians who wanted to build large stone monuments that would last forever, the Chinese understood that nothing lasts forever, so they built things out of wood, knowing that they would have to be replaced beam by beam as the parts of it rotted. But they understood that what mattered was, for them, the form of the monument, so that as long as each beam was replaced with the same kind of care and craftsmanship as it was made, that the monument would be the same in spirit and form. And so that in Japan, even now, one of the great ancient monuments of Japan, the Issei Shrine, is ritually destroyed and rebuilt every 20 years, which completely confounds Westerners, because even UNESCO, the UN organization that looks after cultural heritage, refuses to designate it as an ancient monument. For them, it's a few years old, whereas the Japanese consider it to be 1,300 years old, even though its actual parts are of recent construction.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to, in different chapters, look at the way the different cultures think about these issues and, make people realize that the particular set of notions we have about the past and monuments and original objects are particular to our society.
Yeah, relationships. Yeah, relationships with the past can be very different culture to culture.
And even within our own culture across time, for example, in Rome in the 17th century, just 300 or 400 years ago, architects there were using the Colosseum as a rock quarry. They thought nothing about just knocking off pieces of the Colosseum to use to build columns of churches or walls of buildings. The idea that the past was sacred is ironically a very modern idea. And so I wanted to, it's sort of, strangely enough, being obsessed with the past is part of being modern, and that's one of the themes of the book.
Mm. It's interesting to think, if I'm recalling this correctly, I believe that at some point in our history, not far from here, the Cahokia Mounds, they were destroyed. Some of them were destroyed because they were simply in the way.
Mm-hmm.
But today we would, a horrible hue and cry would go up. We would never do that.
Right. No, we've changed and evolved a lot. I mean, if you consider that, you know, in New York City, the movement for historical preservation dates only from the 1970s. The early 1970s, the Penn Station, the big train station in the middle of New York, which was considered to be an architectural masterpiece of the Beaux-Arts architectural firm of McKim, Mead, and White, it was just leveled in order to make an extremely ugly modern train station and Madison Square Garden sports arena, which are both singled out as among the least interesting buildings in New York, and we destroyed an architectural masterpiece. After that, landmark legislation was passed, and the whole movement of historical preservation was created, but it's a very recent thing. Even the preoccupation with preserving nature as something that should be preserved is very much a product of our very recent history. You know, somebody like Theodore Roosevelt, who president of the early 20th century, is one of the big proponents of the creation of national parks in this society. It's only as we've begun to industrialize intensively and destroy and develop large parts of the country that people began to think about nature as something that should be preserved in a way. Nature becomes in our time a little bit like objects in a museum or animals in a zoo. These things are all part of our way of relating to the world, our awareness that that human development has accelerated so rapidly in our time that we have to actually think about the world we live in, the things in it, and our own past as precious commodities that are diminishing in number quickly.
Mm. There's another fascinating, all the essays are really fascinating, but I want to move on to a man by the name of Veer Bhadra Mishra, mm-hmm. and how he relates to the world. In this essay, in this piece of reporting, we find a man who has married tradition, spirituality, with modernity and engineering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this actually was one of my favorite experiences in reporting for this book. I had heard about attempts to try to preserve the Ganges River in India, and it immediately sort of fired my imagination, both because of the enormous difficulty of the task of trying to preserve a river that helps to keep half a billion people alive every day, and that cuts through several countries, and is also this river is a mythological force in India. The Hindus consider the Ganges to be a goddess. They consider its water to be pure and to be purifying to everyone that steps into it. And they even cook with Ganges water because they consider it to be holy. But the reality of the last 50 years or so is that the water is becoming increasingly polluted and dangerous for the people who use it. So that to me seemed like a kind of metaphor for the problem of modern India, which is both trying to preserve its traditional identity and its religion and culture, but at the same time industrialize and gain access to Western technology and economic well-being. And I then stumbled upon the main character of this chapter, V.B. Mishra, who combines these two elements so very eloquently, because he's both the head of one of the Mahant, or head of one of the biggest temples in Varanasi, which is the holy city of the Ganges. But he's also a trained engineer who teaches hydraulic engineering at the local university. So that as a Hindu, every morning he wakes up in his house by the Ganges and wants to go down and bathe in the river in order to perform his pujas or religious duties in the river. But he also has a state-of-the-art laboratory in his temple complex, which is measuring the fecal coliform count of the water he's about to go in. So he knows better than almost anyone exactly how dangerous and polluted the water is. And so his, you know, and as he told me, he said, you know, I have a war in my heart between his religious feeling for the river and his knowledge as a scientist about the danger of the river. And yet, what I found so refreshing and interesting about him and the people that I've met in India was that rather than despairing over this conflict, in his case, he's trying to use his scientific knowledge to clean the river in order to preserve the traditions that have grown up around the Ganges. And that that experience was incredibly exciting and enlightening to me, because it also it made me see that there was a real connection between between, let's say, the desire to preserve a piece of nature and the culture around it. So that Mishra, for example, said to me at one point, please consider them an endangered species, these people who have a living relationship with the river, not just birds and plants, but those who still have this faith. If birds can be saved, if plants can be saved, let this species of people be saved by granting them holy water. And so that it made me see a real kind of integral connection between my interest in the preserving of culture and the preserving of species and of biodiversity. And what is, in a way, also, I think, very exciting and interesting about the India experience that I tried to document was the very sort of creative and unexpected ways that people around the world are digesting Western culture and creating hybrid forms of culture, which are probably what we are destined to end up with. Because on the one hand, globalization is to some degree remaking the world in an American image. And, you know, when you turn on Indian TV, for instance, you see a lot of programs which look rather suspiciously like MTV. And you have Rupert Murdoch's Star Channel, which has a lot of programming in common with, you know, the Murdoch stations, the Warner Brothers stations in this country. But luckily, the Indians are also very rooted in their own culture and have a way of transforming what they borrow and turning it into something original and interesting. For instance, when I was in Varanasi, I was there during a major holiday feast day, which was the wedding of Shiva and Parvati, Shiva being the god who, in fact, created the Ganges by letting it down from the Himalayas in the locks of his tangled locks of his hair, as Hindu legend would have it. And so they celebrate his marriage with great joy in Varanasi, and great celebration. In the midst of these celebrations, you would see around the city shrines to Shiva, which often they're very old, ancient shrines, which take the form of phallic symbols. In some of these shrines, I noticed that people had them decked out in brightly colored electric lights that were pulsing to Hindi pop music. And I looked at this and I thought, oh my God, you know, we've destroyed them too. Everything is becoming Las Vegas. And then as I kind of sat there looking at it, I realized, well, this actually isn't Las Vegas. This means something completely different from them and to them than it means to me, because they are, in fact, still worshiping this shrine with the same kind of intensity and devotion as before. They're just borrowing something they find interesting and attractive, which are these electric lights and this pulsating music, and turning it toward the, you know, their own devotional purposes. And it has a cultural meaning that's very different than the lights and the music would have in our context. And so I think that's a kind of indication of what we're beginning to see around the world, which is a kind of hybrid culture, which is neither purely Western or traditional Asian or African or South American culture.
Yeah. Well, maybe to wrap up here, if it would be okay with you, I would quote Mishra from your piece. He says, "These things, satellite television, internet surfing, are with us whether we like it or not. They are means. They can be used in a beautiful way. It is as if you are riding a lion. You should be strong enough to tame the lion, or it will eat you."
Yeah, I think very wise words.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you, and I really would recommend the book to our listeners if our conversation this afternoon has intrigued you, interested you. Look for the future of the past. Alexander, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Alexander Steele has been our guest this afternoon. The Future of the Past is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux.